Suffering is part and parcel of life. It seems to me that the general impression that people have is that bad people suffer, or maybe they are the ones that should suffer. But the simple reality is that it's not just bad people who suffer, righteous people suffer. And that's the part that gives us a hard time. Now, I'm not going to labor the fact that righteous people suffer. That's a given, and we all understand that. What I want to do is address the issue of how do you respond to that? What is the right response to undeserved suffering? That when you suffer, as no fault of your own. I mean, you can do something stupid and break your leg, but what happens when it's not your fault and you break your leg, to use a simple illustration? How do you respond to that? Well, it seems to me the answer to that, the classic answer to that, is in the book of Job. So may I invite your attention to Job chapter 1. And while you're turning there, let me mention something about the book in its entirety. This book has a very interesting feature about it. It's divided into three parts. The first part could be called a prologue, an introduction. That goes from the first verse down to chapter 2, verse 10. Then there is the body of the book, which is a series of conversations. And it ends with what many call an epilogue. The epilogue begins in chapter 42, verse 7, and goes to the end of the book. Now, what's interesting about that is that the prologue is written in prose. The body of the book that begins in 2:11 and goes to 42, verse 7, is written in poetry. And then he comes back and ends the book in prose again. Now, that isn't immediately obvious necessarily as you're reading the English text, but it really is obvious when you're reading the Hebrew text, and some English translations mark that out by the way they print the various verses. At any rate, I thought that was interesting, and what we're going to do is begin with part of the prologue. We're just going to consider the first part in chapter 1. Next time, we'll consider the second part of the prologue, which is in chapter 2, the first 10 verses. But for today, let's just look at the opening verses of Job. As I understand this chapter, it's a simple story. You could just tell the story. You probably know the story. But I want to divide the chapter and the story of the chapter into four different distinctive episodes or points, if you will. And rather than reading the whole chapter, I'm going to read it as we go through it. The first thing that this does is give us Job's character. Verses 1 through 5 are just describing for us who Job is. By the way, the traditional way to tell a story is to do just that. You start by describing the characters. Now, it's not the only way to tell a story, but it's the standard, classic, traditional way to tell a story, and that's what this book does. So look at the first five verses. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright and one who feared God and shunned evil. And seven sons and three daughters were born to him. Also, his possessions were 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen. That means there were 1,000 total. 500 female donkeys and a very large household, so that this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. And his sons would go and feast in their houses, each to his appointed day, interesting phrase, and would send and invite their three sisters to eat and drink with them. And it was so that when the days of fasting ran their course, that Job would send and sanctify them, and he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them. For Job said, it may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. Thus Job did regularly. Now, as I said a minute ago, these opening verses are describing Job with a focus on his character. And for example, in the first verse, we are told four things about him. That he was blameless. Wow. That Hebrew word means he was morally innocent. He was a man of integrity. He was morally and ethically pure. If you look the word up in a Hebrew dictionary, that's what you would find. So he was a moral man. He was a man of integrity. The next word in verse 1 is that he was upright. And that means he was a straight shooter, so to speak, in the sense of not deviating from God's standard. He was straight, upright. The word means correct, right, straight. The third description of him is that he feared God. I need to pause here for a minute. We hear the word fear and we immediately think of being afraid. What does the Hebrew word mean? Well, the Hebrew word that's translated fear has four different little nuances in it. One is to be afraid, even to be terrified. The second is to stand in awe. The third nuance is reverence, and the fourth is to honor. So that all those things are bound up in this word. And I think when it comes right down to it, is the way it's used, the fear of the Lord is used in the Old Testament. It's apparent that it involves knowing the Lord, reverencing the Lord, and under certain circumstances, being afraid of the Lord. So this really focuses on his relationship to the Lord, but it's not just that he was terrified of the Lord. It's that he stood in awe of the Lord. He reverenced the Lord and was afraid if he stepped out of line, the Lord would discipline him. So it's that kind of a fear. The last thing that's said about him is that he shunned evil. And shun means, obviously, to turn aside, to depart, to avoid. So he did as much as he could to avoid sin. So to sum up, or to put these things in a slightly different order, Job feared God, avoided evil, lived a moral life. He was pious toward God, kind toward his family, just toward his neighbor, and benevolent toward the poor. Job was quite an exemplary man. One author said, "This is a book that can hold its own anywhere, whether in the university lecture hall or the beer hall. Its hero is one that can strike a chord with people who have never drawn any biblical story or figure, including Jesus. Many reject Jesus, but nobody rejects Job. The world respects Job simply by suffering so enormously, by hanging in for dear life through it all. Job won the world's heart and has come to embody the struggling of all mankind." What a fellow. So the book just starts out saying he was a man that knew the Lord, feared the Lord, honored the Lord, and that spilled over into his relationships with other people. He was a man of integrity and character. The next thing we're told is that he had a lot of children. Verse 2 says he had 10 children and 7 were sons. Now, it was common in that day to have large families. It was considered normal. There's nothing unusual about that. To have 7 sons was considered to be a particular blessing. Given the value system of that day, if you had sons, well, that's true in some societies even today, isn't it? That having a son was a blessing. To have 7 out of 10, well, you can see that was a great blessing for Job. Then it tells us about his property. Wow. Look at verse 3. His possessions were 7,000 sheep. Now, the 7,000 sheep were provided food and clothing. Then he had 3,000 camels. That was provided transportation. He had a garage like Jay Leno. 3,000 cars. Then he had a 500 yoke of oxen, which means he had 1,000 oxen total, and they were used for plowing. The 500 donkeys are interesting. They were used for transportation, but it noted the text says they were female donkeys. Female donkeys provided milk. I didn't know that until I studied this passage. But these are his possessions. Job's very large household included servants to take care of all of that livestock. This passage is describing the wealth of an Arab ruler or chieftain. He was so rich and influential that his private estate would have been virtually a self-contained town. He was the greatest, we're told in this passage, in wealth of all the people in the East. Now, there were other wealthy people in the East, and this text tells us at the end of verse 3, this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. He surpassed them all. So he was a man, a godly man, a righteous man, and a wealthy man. Now, what the passage does next is it tells us about his piety. And this is a little interesting. Pick up at verse 4. His sons would go and feast in their houses, each on his appointed day. Huh. What is his appointed day? Some have suggested, and I think with merit, that this means on their birthday. They had a birthday party. And when they did, they invited their siblings. Now, what's significant about this is the text tells us in verse 5 that in the days when those feasts run their course, that Job would send and sanctify them. He would get up early in the morning and offer burnt sacrifices for them just in case they had sinned. Interesting point of view. Now, that tells us something about this whole book. He could not have done that. He would not have done that after the time of Moses, because then you would take a lamb, a sacrifice, to the priest, right? So this tells us that this book was written before the time of Moses and the institution of the Mosaic Law. Matter of fact, because of that little observation and some others, many have concluded that he lived during the time of Abraham, and that this is probably the first book in the Old Testament to be written. So he was acting as a priest for his children. Now, during the Mosaic Law time, they couldn't and wouldn't do that. Of course, we are priests today, and we can. So, the first 5 verses are telling us about Job's character. And in a word, he was a godly, righteous man. He was rich and righteous. If we had time, I could go to other verses in the book and show other things about him. For example, in chapter 29, it is said he was highly respected. In chapter 29, it says he was a fair and honest judge, a wise counselor, an honest employer. Chapter 31, that he was hospitable and generous, and a farmer of crops. So there's all kinds of things we can learn just about Job the person. His prosperity did not adversely affect his piety. In fact, the indication is that his piety, an indication of his piety is what he did with his wealth. And as we go through the book, we will discover that he acknowledged that his material possessions were a gift from God. That's in later in this chapter. He used his wealth to help people. That's mentioned in chapter 4 and chapter 29 and chapter 31. He also rescued the needy, which is mentioned later in the book. So someone has said, moreover, all of this was done without any government programs or assistance, without any tax benefit or receipts for charitable donations. Job's wealth did not cling to him, it flowed through him. He was not so much a collector of wealth as a distributor of it, not an owner, but a steward. He was the rarest of millionaires, one that was not filthy rich, but one who was clean rich. End of quote. Love it. Now, if there was anybody that did not deserve suffering, it was Job. So here is a righteous man, and as we will see very shortly, who underwent some severe suffering. Now, I said this chapter is divided into four parts, and the first part was Job's character. The second part is Satan's claim. And that starts in verse 6 and goes through verse 12. So let's read those verses. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord. The sons of God in this passage is a reference to angels. And virtually everybody agrees with that. I don't think that's a greatly debated point. They presented themselves before the Lord, and that seems to be that they came to report, that God had given them jobs to do, and they had come to report before the Lord. Well, when they came, Satan came with them. The Hebrew word Satan means adversary. And the Lord, I'm sure, listened to the sons of God make their report, and he said to Satan, from where do you come? Satan answered and said, from going to and fro on the earth, and from walking back and forth in it. Now you can be sure that when Satan's walking up and down the earth, he's up to no good. Peter says that Satan is a roaring lion, roaming around, seeing who he could devour. He's an adversary. And he's adversarial toward God's children. So he readily admits, I'm wandering around to see who I can do in. So God says to Satan, verse 8, have you considered my servant Job? That there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil. Now that is an exact repetition of what was said in verse 1. Have you considered Job? He's a godly, righteous man. How about him? So Satan answered and said, does Job fear God for nothing? All right, so he fears God. But look at all that stuff you've given him. In other words, he's only doing it because he gets out of it. He's devoted because of the dollars. That's all. He says in verse 10, have you not made a hedge around him? Around the household and around all that he has on every side, you have blessed the work of his hands and the possessions have increased in the land. But now stretch out your hand and touch all that he has and he will surely curse you to your face. Satan says, you know, I've been watching this guy. And one thing I saw is that he just has a ton of wealth. So no wonder he blesses you and fears you. It's because all that blessing you give him. It's not out of gratitude. It's because of the gifts you give him. Oh boy, do we need to think about that for a minute. Do we serve the Lord out of gratitude or because of the gifts we get? Has the Lord blessed us? Oh yeah. So do we keep serving because we want the gifts, or is it out of gratitude? Well, that's Satan's penetrating question. And I'm just going to surmise, he says, that Satan's doing it for the wrong reason. Why else would you do all this? I mean, you get that much stuff out of it. Of course you're going to do that. But I'm going to tell you, if you took all that stuff away, he'd curse you. He wouldn't bless you. He would curse you. So, going back to the passage and picking up at verse 12, the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your power." But only do not lay a hand on his person. This is a very important verse. God is giving Satan permission to take away all of Job's possessions, but he can't touch him personally. What is interesting about this and what is important about this is that he has to get permission. It's a very important lesson. Apparently, Satan couldn't do anything to Job unless he got permission first. Matter of fact, he says, "You put a hedge around him. I can't get to him." Right? So take down that hedge and we'll see how much he loves you. So that's Satan's claim. And God has said, "All right, I'm going to tell you, Job's not going to curse me. I'll let you do that. Take away his, don't touch his person, but take away all his possessions." So the third part of the story is what I'm going to call Job's calamities. And it starts in verse 13. And this moves in rapid fire succession. "Now there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking in their oldest brother's house." Now that probably goes back to verse 4 and indicates they were having a birthday party in the oldest son's house. "And a messenger came to Job and said, 'The oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them. And the shebeens raided them and took them away. Indeed, they have killed the servants and with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you.'" Remember the queen of Sheba? Well, these are people from that part of the Middle East. And he is simply saying that they raided part of your possessions. The 1,000 oxen and the 500 donkeys and all the servants but one were destroyed, taken away, lost. So then he says, that's the first round, that's the first calamity. The second one comes in verse 16. "And while he," that one servant who escaped, still speaking, "another came and said, 'The fire of God fell from heaven and burnt up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you.'" What's the fire of God? It's probably a reference to lightning. There was a lightning strike, and 700 sheep were consumed, and all the servants attending those were destroyed except one, and I escaped, and I alone came to tell you what was happening. Bam! One right after another. Verse 17, "While he was speaking, another came and said, 'The Chaldeans formed three bands, raided the camels and took them away, yes, and killed the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to come and tell you.'" So, now he says, that other part of the wealth you had, the other third, was camels. You had 3,000 camels, and the Chaldeans came and killed all the servants. I'm the only one that's left, and I came to tell you, and the Chaldeans took away all the camels. Verse 18, and while he was still speaking, another also came and said, your sons and daughters are eating and drinking with their wine in their oldest brother's house. And suddenly a great wind, probably a tornado, came from across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell on the young people, and they're dead. And I alone have escaped to tell you. So one right after the other. There are four tragedies. Two foreign invasions and two natural disasters that wipe out everything Job has. And in rapid succession, all in one day, one servant gives the message, and no sooner does he finish than a second one comes, and while he's still talking, a third one comes and a fourth. Lord Byron, the famous English literary figure, said, truth is always stranger than fiction. This is not fiction. It's truth. It happens. It was in rapid succession, and it was devastating. I want you to imagine that there's a businessman that has quite a bit of business overseas. And he's enjoying dinner one night when he gets a message on his cell phone that there's been an uprising in one country where he has a lot of business. And one third of his business has been wiped out. And all the employees except one, the one calling him on his cell phone, have been killed. He's devastated. Just that, he's devastated. And while he's talking, he gets another phone call on his cell phone, and another one says, in another part of another place where he has some foreign investments, there's been an 8.0 earthquake, and all of your factories have been wiped out, and all the employees there have been killed, and I'm the only one that survived. And the man is shocked beyond belief. And while he's talking to the second employee, the phone, he gets in his ear that another is calling, and a third calls and says, there's been another uprising in another part of the country where you have business, and all your business has been wiped out, and all the employees have been killed, and I'm the only one that has survived. And if all of that is not bad enough, somebody says, I hate to break the news to you, but all of your kids have been killed in a hideous automobile accident. They were all piled in a little minibus, and a drunk driver crossed the lane and hit them head on and killed them all. Now, I'm simply trying to paint the picture of what Job must have gone through. Any one of those would have been devastating, but one. Right on top of the other. Bam, bam, bam. All for Satan to prove that he's doing it all for the wrong reason. Now, what I've done so far is talk about Job's character. He was a godly, righteous man. I've talked about Satan's claim. Satan didn't buy it. He was the adversary that said, he's just doing it all for selfish reasons because you put a hedge around him and blessed him so much. And so God said, all right, I'll tell you what, I'll let you go take it all away, but you can't touch his person. And we'll see. So we've seen Job's calamity. I said there were four parts to this story. The last part I'm going to call Job's comeback. How he responded to this. Look at verse 20. And Job arose, tore his robe, shaved his head, fell on the ground, and worshiped. And he said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. The Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And in all this, Job did not sin nor charge God with wrong. Now, I said at the beginning, what I really wanted to do today is lay out how to respond to undeserved suffering. What I had to do was spell out the suffering, which is what I've done. But now what I want to do is spell out the proper response. I want you to see how Job responded to this. He did three things. By the way, this is where you should take note. You ever suffered? Did you ever suffer and you didn't think you deserved it? You want to know how to respond? This is it. Number one, grieve. That's what he's telling us in verse 20. Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head and fell on the ground and worshiped. So the first thing he did is he grieved. That's the meaning of tore his robe and shaved his head. Those are the outward signs of internal grief. As a matter of fact, the tearing of the robe is something of a symbol of the tearing of the heart. This is the way I feel. My heart's been torn in two. And the other part of that, the shaving of the head, is my glory has departed. So, he grieved. Now, I want to say something about that. It's okay to grieve. Yes. I think I've known some Christians who thought it wasn't okay to grieve. And if you're really spiritual, you wouldn't grieve, right? You know anybody like that? I mean, they're more pious than God. Now, hear me. Paul says, we sorrow. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, we sorrow. And he's talking about the loss of a loved one. We sorrow. Not as others who have no hope, but we sorrow. So it is perfectly natural and normal to go through the grieving process. By the way, psychologists have done some interesting study about grief. The first response is denial. If I said to you tonight, somebody you know passed away, your first response would be, oh no. Right? The second response is guilt. You think, I wish I had said, I wish I had done. You ever had that happen? Boy, I have. And you feel guilty. I wish I had said before this happened. I wish I had done, you know. The next phase is anger. That is, people get angry. Sometimes is, you left me. Get angry at the person who died. Or, and I've had people tell me this, they get angry at God for allowing it. So, those are the three. And there's some have five, some have seven. But those are the three, when I talk to people, I use a lot. And I want you to know, it's normal to go through that. It's normal to be angry. It's normal to feel guilty. It's normal to grieve. When there is a loss, when you suffer loss, grieve. And don't be embarrassed about that, and don't make apologies for it. It's healthy to grieve. That's what Job did. The second thing is that he worshiped. Now, what does that mean? What do you mean he worshiped? The way the word worshiped is used today is it's reserved primarily for music at the Sunday morning service and is synonymous with praise. I don't think that's what's going on here. He's not singing. I'm not even sure he's praising. The Hebrew word, and you've heard me talk about this before, means to bow down. If you've seen Muslims in a mosque on their knees and bowing their forehead till it touches the ground, that is the meaning of the Hebrew word worship. That's what it says he did. Look at it. He fell to the ground and worshiped. He bowed his head so that his forehead touched the dirt. So what's the point? Well, I think that the point is he didn't curse God. He submitted to the Lord. That this is an act of humility and submission. That he's saying, in essence, Lord, I submit to whatever you've given me. Now, I get part of that from what he said. And what he said is, he acknowledged God's sovereignty. Listen to this. You know, reality is, when I came to the world, I didn't have a thing. I was naked. Didn't have clothes to put on my back. That's the naked truth. And when I die, you can't take it with you. Now, Paul echoes this truth in 1 Timothy 6:7, where he says, we didn't bring anything into the world and we're not going to take anything out. So his point is, the Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Wow. He grieved. He submitted to whatever the Lord gave him. And he acknowledged God's sovereignty. That's how you respond to undeserved suffering. Look at verse 22. In all of this, he did not charge God with wrong. He didn't curse God. He proved Satan wrong. He didn't get drunk. Didn't pop pills. Didn't blame the Chaldeans. Didn't blame God for the natural disasters. Didn't attempt suicide. Didn't sin. How do you do that? You acknowledge God's sovereignty. Now, folks, if you forget everything I've said, and the chances are you will, this is what you need to remember tonight. The Lord gives, and the Lord taketh away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Maybe worship did include some praise. He blessed the Lord. He submitted to the Lord first, and then acknowledged God's sovereign. Blessed be the name of the Lord. So let me sum this up, and then let me make just some real clear observations. What I'm saying is the right response to the loss of possessions and loved ones through no fault of your own is to grieve, humble yourself before God, and recognize his sovereignty. And that recognize his sovereignty is the key to this. So let me spell it out. Let me break it down. Number one, God's sovereign. This passage indicates that two ways. The Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Now we really bless the Lord and praise him when he gives. I have a praise report. The Lord answered prayer. I've never been in a prayer meeting where somebody came in and said, I have a praise report. I lost everything. But you see, if you were Job, that's what you would do. So one indication that this passage is teaching God is sovereign is Job said, the Lord gives and the Lord taketh away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. The other is God put a hedge around him and Satan had to get permission. So anything that happens to you only comes through God's permission. Amen. If you're a child of God. Amen. But what you have to understand is God is sovereign. Commenting on this passage, Warren Wiersbe said, from the outset, the writer reminds us that no matter what happens in this world or in our lives, God is on the throne and has everything under control.
Amen.
You believe that?
Yes.
It'll be tested when you lose everything. Second observation. Satan is alive and active in the world. Satan is headed for the lake of fire, Revelation chapter 20, but he's not there yet. I think we often imagine that Satan is in hell. Satan goes to church. 2 Corinthians teaches that. He transforms himself into an angel, a messenger of light. Satan doesn't go to bars, he goes to churches. He doesn't sit in the pew, he stands behind the pulpit. So he's alive and well, but you need to remember, he can't do anything to you unless he gets permission. So he can only do to a believer what God permits. So, this passage teaches us God is sovereign, Satan is alive in the world, and number three, the righteous suffer. This passage labors the point that Job was righteous, and yet he suffered. Good people experience bad things. The righteous suffer through no fault of their own. Job suffered, not because of anything he did, but to silence Satan's accusations. We suffer to glorify God and to be conformed to the image of Christ. So we need to establish up front as we study this book, this has become very important later, of no fault of his own. It's very important. He was righteous. He was godly. He was a man of character and integrity. So ultimately, the issue is not the greatness of the suffering nor the timing of the suffering. It's our reaction to the suffering, no matter how big or how small it may be. And that's the fourth point. God is sovereign. Satan is alive. The righteous suffer. But the real issue is, how do you respond to suffering? I want to make an observation. This is the bottom line of this passage. For Job, worshiping God was second nature. He didn't have to grieve for 6 months until he said, "The Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." He got all of these horrific reports and immediately fell to the ground. Right? So this was his initial response. It was a spontaneous reaction to the greatest of tragedies. Now, this is the point. Such a person does not come naturally or spontaneously to that. It is a practiced response. It is the fruit of long faith and discipline. You don't do this with this kind of suffering until you've done it in little sufferings. Now, the point is, the passage points out this was a godly man, that he was so sensitive to the things of the Lord that when his children had a birthday party, he went and gave a sacrifice to the Lord. That's the key to "the Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." He could never have reacted the way he did unless he had practiced this all of his life. So when that lesson is learned, there can be submission when there's a broken heart and bitter tears. We can honor the Lord whether we are clothed or naked. In Philippians chapter 4, the Apostle Paul says, I have learned in whatsoever state I am to be content. I've learned how to be abased and how to abound. The key word is, I have learned. You don't get this overnight. So you need to start practicing now the lessons of this passage. You need to start practicing now to grieve, to get all that negative stuff out of your system, and to be submissive to the Lord, and above and beyond everything, to acknowledge His sovereignty. In a word, the Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. If I may quote Warren Wiersbe again on this passage, he wrote, gold fears no fire. Whatever we have that is burned up and left behind in the furnace wasn't worth having anyway. I'm going to tell you a story. A story I think most of you have heard. I hesitate to even tell these kind of stories, but this one has a value. I'm going to tell you the story, but I want to make a point that maybe you missed, and it is this. 4 years ago, matter of fact, February 28th was 4 years. It was my anniversary. I had an unexpected spinal cord injury. I had an abscess in my spinal column that leaned against the spinal cord and knocked out my legs. I couldn't stand up. I couldn't sit on the side of the bed. Matter of fact, my wife reminded me, I was in in-house therapy at UCLA for 5 weeks, flat on my back, and the first time I got out and came back to church in a wheelchair was Easter Sunday. So Easter Sunday, 4 years ago, I came in a wheelchair. Now, the part of the story is, I was stunned. I had no idea what was going on or what was going to happen. I just knew I couldn't walk. Couldn't imagine what that was about. But it took them 26 hours to figure out what was wrong. They finally called in a professor from UCLA, and she figured it out. And the minute they did, they prepared the emergency, the operating room immediately and rushed me into emergency surgery. So they put me on this gurney, and they're hauling me in. And just before they're taking me into this room, of course, they knocked me out, and I don't know what's going on, but I met the surgeon. I hadn't met him before. It's an African-American surgeon that apparently had been noticed in Time magazine. And I looked at him and I said, I'm a believer. And I quoted this passage. The Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And this surgeon looked at me and said, I'm a spirit-filled Christian. I understand. And he wheeled me into surgery. Now that sounds like I'm a super saint. So you just run out and go do the same thing, right? And the reason I told you that story again, and most of you have heard it, is no. I'm not sure I could have done that 10 years ago. I'm certain I couldn't have done it 20. And that's the point. I could do that because I learned to practice that in a lot of little things. So when the 101 or 405 gets plugged up in the morning, your response is? The Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And when you can handle that level of a problem, He may increase it to see just how much you are really willing to do. Got it? That is the right response to undeserved suffering. Father, thank you for honoring us, to allow us to suffer for your sake. Now, Lord, give us the grace to do that in a godly manner so that we may glorify you and grow to spiritual maturity. In Jesus' name, amen.